Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really matter. Coming up on the program, a big gap exists between boards and chief executives on what real support looks like. Businesses under pressure as new equity targets come into force. Young investors leading the way in shifting wealth offshore. And artificial intelligence won't fix your business until you know what the problem is that you're solving. It's Wednesday, the 16th of April. The relationship between a chief executive officer and the board of directors is meant to be one of strategic partnership and support. But what if it's actually a source of strain or even a drag on performance? There's a new global survey by the executive search and leadership consulting firm Spencer Stuart that suggests a confidence gap might exist between CEOs and boards, with fewer than a quarter of chief executives saying they feel effectively supported to navigate today's complex business environment. So I want to discuss those findings in a little more detail and what the disconnect means for leadership and performance. And I'm with Guy Lundy, who's country manager for Spencer Stuart in South Africa. Guy, that figure of 22% and a warm welcome to you in your study says they only get effective support from their boards. Why would that number be so low?
Thanks, Jeremy, for having me. I think the reason that CEOs tend to feel that they're not getting the sort of support that they would like to get locally and internationally is because of a disconnect that tends to exist between board members and CEOs. I don't think that they get to meet often enough, and I don't think that they get to talk about strategic issues as often as they possibly should do, with too much focus on governance potentially.
And why do you think that's happening?
I think that boards have possibly been set up with the old way of doing things in mind. So, boards have been doing the same sorts of things for a very long time. And the world has changed quite dramatically, and particularly recently has changed significantly. The world's moving a lot faster. We can use technology a lot better than we do in terms of keeping people connected more regularly. And then also looking at the kind of board members that one has, you know, people that have experience in the industry and could spend more time with the CEO giving experience insights from their own backgrounds.
There is, of course, the caveat, though, that there needs to be, I imagine, a line of tension between too much involvement and assertive oversight.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we do have examples out there, plenty of examples of boards that are very involved. And you often see where an organization is sort of cycling through CEOs over, you know, every year to 18 months, you end up with a new CEO. One has to question what's happening there between the relationship between the board and the CEO on an ongoing basis. But you also have the other extreme where you've got the CEO that kind of pulls the strings. These are often the sorts of CEOs that when they eventually retire tend to move into the chair role. And you don't want something that's on either of those two extremes, because the one will get far too involved in the minutiae and the detail on a daily basis, and the other won't get involved at all. So it really does come down to having a balance where the board and the CEO see each other as partners in this journey going forward.
This is a global study, but what about South Africa? Are boards here falling into the same trap? In other words, offering governance without any real engagement, as you've referred to?
I think that it is something that we see in South Africa as much as we do internationally. There were South African respondents in this survey of about 2,500 people around the world, both CEOs and board members. And it's interesting. What I found interesting about it was that the results that I would have expected for South Africa are very similar to what we've seen all over the world. So we're not necessarily unique, but we do have similar sorts of challenges in this country as we do elsewhere in the world.
So chief executives have one view, but the report also shows that directors have a completely different view. They, in fact, or many of them, think they're doing a good job. So that disconnect is also worrying.
Yeah, it is. And I can understand why board members would feel that they're probably more engaged than the CEOs feel they are. Because when they come into board meetings and engagements with the CEO, then they do feel very engaged. The CEO, on the other hand, has to go back out into the world of work on a daily basis and then doesn't necessarily get an ongoing level of support from all the board members that they would like to get. And perhaps doesn't have the relationship with the board that they can just pick up the phone, give them a call, and ask for advice. And that's potentially because the boards are seeing themselves purely from that oversight perspective and that governance perspective, as opposed to being there to support and help on a more regular basis. Just in terms of the results, 43% of the board directors felt that they are supporting the CEOs effectively. As much as that's twice the amount that the CEOs feel, it is also below half. So the board members around the world are obviously also feeling that they could be doing a better job of being accessible and supportive of the CEO.
Guy, what I find interesting is that high-performing companies tend to have a better board chief executive relationship. Are there specific practices that make the difference there?
Yeah, I think that the expectation setting between board members and the CEO in terms of what they expect of the CEO and what the CEO can expect of them certainly helps to set the scene. And that then sets it up for a relationship of true partnership, and where the CEO feels that the board is available, effective, and there to support. They then also tend to report that the results are far better.
I hate using this phrase KPIs, but the report also suggests that, and I think you term it proactive expectation setting, improves board support. What does that mean? And again, why do you think that's not happening more often?
Well, I think possibly again, board members sometimes feel or are just somewhat removed. And so, removed from the daily grind of the business, and therefore are not necessarily setting very clear expectations as to what the CEO should be pushing for, and then also are not necessarily renewing it. So one of the things that we would recommend is that those expectations and KPIs are regularly reviewed and looked at in such a fast-changing world.
And just finally, you use that phrase fast-changing world, and this is very apt. Chief executives also want, the report says, more subject matter expertise at board level, and no surprise here, particularly around artificial intelligence, regulation, and digital disruption. It would suggest to me that boards are not necessarily equipping themselves for the future.
It is a bit of a challenge. One of the things that boards always struggle with is that you're looking for people that are at a certain level in their career or a certain stage in their lives where they've had an executive career already, which puts them at an older stage. And they're not necessarily the people that have had the interaction and engagement with things like AI, and new technology. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. And I think that's where boards need to be a bit creative in terms of making sure that they're able to bring that skill into the boardroom that exists out there. And it's not particularly common to have people that really have that knowledge in the board.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Guy Lundy, Country Manager for Spencer Stuart in South Africa. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Moneyweb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this week marks a turning point for South African businesses as the Department of Employment and Labour officially gazettes the final employment equity targets and regulations. For the first time, companies are legally required to meet specific transformation goals or face steep penalties. Now, critics, as you're probably aware, say the targets are unrealistic in a stagnant economy, the department insisting they are non-negotiable. So what now? What does all of this mean for business leaders, and are these regulations transformational or possibly just an overreach? I'm in conversation now with an expert in this particular field, Thembi Chagonda, Joint Chief Executive Officer of Global Business Solutions and Employment Equity Commissioner. Thembi, a very warm welcome to you. Let's get straight to it. How realistic are these targets in an economy that is barely growing, and we know one that is already shedding jobs?
I must say, when one looks at the targets and compare the targets with the economically active population, you can then say that these are realistic targets because they are far less than what the economically active population requirements are. So if you look at it that way, they are realistic. However, the reality of the fact is businesses have struggled over two decades to comply with the employment equity legislation, particularly your top, senior, middle, and junior management level. It's been a struggle for businesses to achieve these targets over these years because of lack of skills, experience, etc. And that's what businesses are saying. And the Department of Labor is saying, you know, you've had over two decades to comply, and we've given you as businesses the opportunity to set your own targets, and over this period you haven't achieved these targets. So that is where we are sitting at now. The department is saying, we've given you the leeway before and you haven't really set targets that are meaningful, and now we need you to comply or else.
Thembi, some businesses are saying the initial consultation process felt like a box-ticking exercise. So what's your response to that, the fact that government perhaps didn't truly listen or gauge enough sentiment around this?
Jeremy, one can say the department has consulted for some time. I think we know that the whole sectoral targets discussion started as early as 2017 with the Employment Equity Act Amendment Bill. And with that, there's been constant discussions and consultation, despite the fact that it has not been enough. I think business has been aware that there are sectoral targets that are coming up. However, the concern is the fact that the businesses have been indicating to the Department of Labor that there are challenges in certain sectors with regards to skills, availability of opportunities, etc. So that is, I think, where the challenge is, because the department feels that, you know, we've consulted enough, you've heard, you've known about these targets for a long time. So, and these targets are not different to what we have discussed in the past. Of course, when we look at the current finalized sectoral targets that are now gazetted, they are certainly different to what was published in February last year. So we are now seeing that there has been an increase, and the argument from the Department of Labor is that over the years, businesses have improved in these occupational levels that are in question. So therefore, it is right to increase the sector targets to be what they have now finally published.
So against that backdrop then, what in your opinion, or which in your opinion, are the sectors that are going to face some difficulty?
I certainly think that your manufacturing industry is going to face difficulties. And of course, there are some sectors, you know, that will have certain challenges. Of course, I mean, the sector targets are there to be reviewed. But I certainly think that in the back of what is happening in the, particularly in the automotive industry, it is a challenge, I think, with the sector struggling to make ends meet. And the economy, just, I mean, as we've seen in the last 3 weeks, the shares of many organizations have dropped, and businesses are struggling to make ends meet. However, I do believe that at the backdrop of that, we still have opportunities. I think where the focus is at is that we still need to promote a diverse and inclusive environment, even though there are certain struggles. And I think the challenge is that we will lose jobs. However, it's of when you do lose jobs and when the businesses improve, how do you transform as a business? How do you create a diverse and inclusive environment in the light of all these challenges that we have? So it's businesses that are going to embrace that and look at the importance of having diverse groups that will definitely win and look at this as a positive opportunity as well to now finally have a target for something that most businesses have been calling that, you know, we don't have the targets. There's a difference between BEE codes and the employment equity legislation. It was not aligning. But now for the first time, the businesses are being given targets, which are not exactly aligned still with the BEE, but it is something that, you know, a business can strive towards in terms of promoting a diverse group of people.
So from a practical and operational level, then, is there recourse or flexibility for businesses in sectors, possibly manufacturing, as you've alluded to, with legitimate structural or skills constraints?
Absolutely, Jeremy. There are 7 justifiable reasons that employers can raise when they are not able to reach the sector targets that are set out for their particular sectors. For example, the business economic factors are one of the justifiable reasons that can be raised. So if you did not have recruitment opportunities or promotional opportunities, or your business did not grow, you are able to justify by indicating that you did not meet the targets. However, the targets are set out to say you need to achieve this by 2030, but if you don't have those opportunities, you are never going to get a fine. You are never going to get a penalty for not achieving that if the opportunities were not available.
Just a quick one in conclusion. How difficult is it going to be for these targets to be monitored and enforced? And are there safeguards in place to ensure that the process is fair and not abused?
I think currently the Department of Employment and Labour has a system that they've been developing for quite some time. So most of the process is going to be automated. So that's going to then eliminate, you know, the sort of human impact in that. So there will be a lot of it that's going to be automated. However, when a business has not achieved its targets, they would be required to raise justifiable grounds, which they will upload into the system, and the system will then issue the certificate. It is when you are now verified by an inspector that process might then be affected by human touch. And I think that's really where I think we might have challenges, is what happens then if the inspector does not agree with your justifiable reasons or your evidence that you have raised to be the reasons for your justifiable reasons for not achieving these targets. So I think the initial process is safe enough, but it's when you bring the human touch that could be challenges. Mm-hmm.
Thembi Tragonda, thank you very much indeed. Joint Chief Executive Officer of Global Business Solutions and also an Employment Equity Commissioner.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this is an interesting one. More and more South Africans, particularly younger investors, are now looking beyond our borders in search of security and growth, as political risk and shrinking local opportunities maybe cloud the JSE. Offshore investing is booming, and surprisingly, it's millennials and the so-called Generation Z who are leading the charge. So I want to explore that in a little more detail with Raymond Gombera, who's a partner at ARK Wealth, as we look what is behind the trend and what it means for the future of South African wealth generation. So Raymond, a very warm welcome. Is this offshore wave then being driven by strategy or fear? Are we starting to lose faith in the local market?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, so I think offshore investing is not anything new to us. I think it's something that's been around for a very long time. I think it's just becoming a bit more mainstream now with access to information and technology. You know, I think people have obviously access to a lot more information. So because of advancement in technology, you know, we get the younger generation that are more savvy, you know, that have got exposure to these sort of tools. They're obviously looking to explore that. And I suppose it makes it easier for them to access markets that are not necessarily accessible here in South Africa.
I'm interested particularly in millennials and the Gen Z cohort. They are investing earlier, but I wonder if they're investing smarter or if they're just falling in love with global apps that make all of this a whole lot easier.
No, you're quite right. And I think, you know, there's just a vast array of information available, you know, so I think there's different, you know, drivers to, you know, why sort of millennials and your Gen Zs are looking at investing. And some of them are credibly looking at, you know, just saving for retirement, funny enough, at an early age. So starting early is something, one of the key drivers that we're seeing in markets. And some of them just exploring, you know, wanting to understand how exactly they can build their wealth for legacy purposes. And I suppose, you know, starting early is always the proverbial sort of undertaking that, you know, a lot of investors, you know, are given, especially at an early age. So I think it's more just accessibility, really. And the fact that now, you know, within the comfort of your own home, you know, you can set yourself up, get an app downloaded. Most of the sort of banks available in South Africa even offer the service. So I think it's just the convenience to access some of these markets.
So accessibility is one side of the argument, but I guess you've also got to ask the question if the average young investor is equipped to handle things like tax complexity and maybe even currency volatility.
Correct. So that's why, you know, it's always important to engage with the experts in the field. You know, a lot of people get their hands burnt, you know, by sort of, you know, going their own way, making their own decisions. But I think it's always prudent planning to actually tackle and go on that journey with somebody who is well-versed on that space. You know, especially from a currency perspective and also from a tax perspective, we find there are a lot of, you know, complexities that come with offshore investing. So you don't want to look at it on one end as just, you know, how can I grow my money from X to Y? I think it's more important to look at, okay, so what does that mean when I take money out of the country? What are the liabilities that before, you know, if I would, God forbid, was to pass away, you know, some of the estate duties, CITES tax, for example, is a topical one. You know, if you access certain markets and certain shares, you know, so these are some of the complexities that we advise even the baby boomers and the Gen Zs to tackle and just get that hand-holding from experts in the market.
It's also difficult, I would imagine, for you to tailor a long-term strategy for someone who is living from paycheck to paycheck and is probably highly geared.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, so it is quite difficult, but I think, you know, there's always some middle ground of sorts. You know, I think, you know, the whole point is the act of actually engaging and investing and wanting to go that route, which, to be fair, I mean, wasn't really mainstream, you know, years back. You know, it was only accessible when you could only access the stocks through stockbrokers, going through rims of paper for you to access any sort of markets. So now I think it's more just a case of wanting to access the markets. But I think more importantly, it's just engaging the markets, the practice of wanting to explore that option and grow your money, I think is exactly what's attractive to most of these younger generations.
Do you think there's a more worrying and perhaps a broader concern here, given this trend that you've pointed out to me? Is the JSE still relevant going forward then, or are we seeing a slow death of South Africa's capital markets?
I wouldn't necessarily say slow death. I think it just means that, you know, the investment pool in South Africa is lessening unless something drastic changes where, you know, the JSE obviously comes with measures to make it more attractive for companies to list. You know, I think it is a worrying sort of trend because obviously it just means that your investment pool in South Africa is limited. South Africa makes up less than 1% of the global economy. So with these companies coming off the JSE, you know, I mean, that pool is lessening as we go forward. So why not explore the other 99% out there in global markets with the potential better growth and better outcomes?
But in that respect, some critics will say that offshore investing accelerates capital flight and weakens our economy.
No, fair point. But I think it just, you know, it boils down to the individual. You know, what are your fundamentals? What are you looking to do? What are you looking to achieve? And unfortunately, I mean, it's a very personal decision. You know, if you're not really getting, you know, what you're looking for on the local markets, then why not explore offshore markets? So yes, it may result in money leaving South Africa, but that's the unfortunate bit, because, you know, there isn't really that attractiveness in the local market for us to keep hold of some of the money.
And just finally then, it's all about risk management and risk mitigation. You can't see diversification as a silver bullet in its entirety. You've got to have a full stack of options here.
No, for sure. And I think offshore investing, I mean, we're not saying, you know, just now all of a sudden, you know, take all of your money out of South Africa in investments and take it out of the country. I think offshore investing is part of a broader picture. You know, I think it's important to have that as part of your sort of investment strategy. It's just part of your prudent planning. I mean, you're not doing yourself a disservice by accessing markets that are not readily available in South Africa. You know, so I think it's all about just making sure that, you know, you understand the risks. You understand exactly how it works. But that's why, you know, companies like Ark Wealth, in partnership with Growth House Financial Services, we are able to provide that handholding to clients for them to understand exactly how it works, some of the risks associated with investing, not just from a growth perspective, but also from, you know, some of the tax liabilities that may befall, you know, your investments if you're not aware of them.
Raymond Gombeta, thank you very much indeed. Partner at Ark Wealth, appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you that artificial intelligence these days is everywhere. It's in the headlines, in boardrooms, and also in business strategies. But here's the question: is it being used wisely? As companies scramble to implement artificial intelligence, many are rushing in without asking a simple, powerful question: why? Well, I want to try and cut through some of that noise, and I'm in conversation now with Charlene Smith, Sales Director at Insight Consulting, and I want to explore how business can maybe move beyond buzzwords and really adopt AI as a problem-solving tool. I think for many organizations, it's just a panic-driven checkbox exercise. Charlene, a very warm welcome, and maybe let me start with this. You say many companies want AI, I get that, but don't actually know what they want it for. Why is this so common, and why is it so complicated?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I think with all the hype and all the noise around AI, I think you can't go a day without bumping into AI something. All the companies out there are just scrambling to do something. And like you said, it definitely has become a box-ticking exercise. Companies are going into panic because they see their competitors are doing something about AI and implementing AI, and they feel that they'll be left behind. But I really want to say to everyone out there, stop the panic and rather take a step back and ask why and what do you want to implement before you rush into anything. And like I said, treat it like a box-ticking exercise.
So what's the biggest risk then of adopting artificial intelligence without first defining that why, as you put it?
I think if you just rush into AI, you most probably won't be aligning your AI solutions to your business objectives. I think it's extremely important to make sure that the AI implementation is aligned to what you want to achieve as a business. And then also to see what use cases do you have lined up within the business where you can apply AI effectively. The other major pitfall for me is also if companies start implementing AI without using clean data. The data quality is no good, which means the AI implementation, we have to use data to train the AI. And at the end of the day, the results of AI will not be desirable because of the quality of data that we feed into the AI.
So how difficult then is it to align AI with those business objectives that you have referred to?
I really think that it is not that difficult. I think the key to this is to start small. When we start small, we can list a few use cases. And I normally ask my clients, what problems do you have within your business? And what efficiencies can we improve? And how can AI help us with this? So if we start with these small use cases, it helps with adoption within in your company. It helps people to not be scared of AI, rather embrace it and then start walking the journey with you. And when you start small, very, very quickly, your list of use cases will grow. It will become part of your everyday and how you run your business.
So let's talk a little further then about starting small. What are the best low-risk entry points for a business that wants to test the concept?
I think once again, once you have identified what problems you have, and I think I mainly focus on automation. When I work with a customer, I look at what are you currently still doing manually that we can very easily automate. A very good example of this is that many of our customers will have a person capturing data from a static document like a PDF. That is a perfect use case for something like AI, where we can teach the bot to rather scrape the data from that AI and input it into your system rather than having someone physically typing it into a system and then obviously risking finger trouble and human error at the same time. So that use case we see a lot, but it's all about automation, making things better, faster, and not having that manual labor that we currently see in many processes.
But that's a problem in South Africa, given that so many people depend on that manual labor for a livelihood. Surely you've got to find that balance between optimizing artificial intelligence and people losing their jobs.
Most definitely. And for me, that is all about AI literacy. I think it's extremely important to make sure our employees understand AI and also the why behind it. I don't think it should be seen as a threat at all. Coming back to that data capture that sits and manually types data into a system, I would rather apply her services to understand what data has been put in the system, rather for her to play, or him or her, to play a QA role and start playing more on the data analysis side to understand the data that's being captured rather than physically capturing data into a system. So for me, it's about literacy, making sure employees are with us on this journey and to ensure that they don't see AI as a threat. They need to see it as something that can improve the way they do their daily job.
I fully accept the argument that tech is only as good as the data. You referred earlier to clean data. How difficult is it then to assess whether data is AI ready?
I think data quality can really not be underestimated when you start any AI project. Like I said earlier, it all starts with data. So we feed data into an AI platform for machine learning, irrespective of what form of AI you're using. Data needs to be fed into the system. And as we feed it, and as I always say to my clients, we need to teach the machine. It's machine learning for a reason. So if our data quality is obviously not of too great, the result of the AI will not be great. So we help our customers to once again improve processes, and it could be small tweaks within your process to make a field in your system a drop-down list, or just make a field a mandatory capture item. You already see data quality improvement by just doing a small tweaks in your existing processes. And then taking it one step further, we assist our customers to use data pipeline or data integration tools. And once again, these tools have AI built in to help you identify possible bad quality within your data. We then help them to put a data council together, or like data stewards. And these guys need to continuously monitor the quality of the data, still using AI in the background, and make sure that the data is of high quality before we start using it for AI or any type of analysis.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Charlene Smith, Sales Director at Insight Consulting. I do appreciate your time today. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. Please join us again tomorrow. We are live at noon and then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.